a further announcement about dinner this evening. Dinner is at an Indian restaurant called Artie's down on Woolloomooloo Wharf. Directions on how to get there if you don't know later. It'll be at 6:30. For non-speakers, it'll cost $40 plus drinks. Very good Indian food. We've used it many times for conference dinners before. I recommend it. If you want to come, please make sure that Pete Evans has your name by lunchtime, please. There's a handout going around for Mark's talk. And I'm now very pleased to introduce Mark Schroeder, who's going to be speaking to us on how to be an expressivist about truth. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. So I want to start by thanking Hugh and the other conference organizers for the opportunity to speak here today, especially because I'm not an expressivist or a pragmatist or a pluralist. But I'll try to keep that under wraps for the rest of the talk. So what I'm going to do today, although the talk's called How to Be an Expressivist About Truth, I'm not actually going to defend an expressivist theory of truth, although I am going to put one on the table. I've got three main goals. The first is to shed some light on why thinking about truth from an expressivist perspective might be a fruitful way of thinking about truth, particularly with respect to issues related to paradox. Second, I want to show how and particularly the extent to which a semantic theory can be explanatory without being inflationary. And the third thing, this will come clear a little bit later, I want to introduce two ideas that I've been finding helpful recently. One of them is what I call commitment theory, and the other one is what I call a divorce between two different theoretical roles for propositions. And those are going to come out over the course of the talk. In order to explain why it is that I think that expressivism is a fruitful way to think about truth, I want to start with two different issues in the literature about truth. Okay, and one has to do with intersubstitutability and whether we're going to endorse the T schema unrestrictedly. Okay, so I think of intersubstitutability this way. It's the idea that somebody who thinks that a sentence S means that P, and perhaps also, as Stephen Barker pointed out to me yesterday, who also thinks that it doesn't have any conventional implicatures, is committed to having the same attitudes towards P and towards the claim that S is true. Okay, and that's the idea of intersubstitutability. I don't want to defend that particularly, but I want to think about the relationship between that and endorsing every instance of the T schema. So plenty of theories of truth have intersubstitutability but don't have the T schema, or conversely. But you might think there's a relationship between those two. You might think that in some way the unrestricted T schema articulates or gives voice to or makes explicit this state of conditional commitment that we're all insofar as if we think that S means that P, then we're committed to having the same attitudes toward S and toward P. Okay. So for example, I think that's particularly clear in Hartree Fields' 2008 book, Saving Truth from Paradox. He's very dissatisfied with theories of truth that don't give us the T schema unrestrictedly, and it's entirely related to his idea that we need full intersubstitutability. The idea is, if we have full intersubstitutability, which he thinks we need, then a language that doesn't also give us the T schema unrestrictedly is going to be expressively incomplete. There's going to be something that we ought to be able to say, we ought to be able to articulate the state of conditional commitment that we're all in, we ought to be able to express that state to make it explicit, and any language that doesn't let us do that is incomplete. So we need to have a way, an understanding of the T schema on which we can accept it. But the problem is, given the existence of the liar sentence, one instance of the T schema, as we all know, is that if liar means that liar is not true, then liar is true just in case liar is not true. And so the project, if you're going to get the unrestricted T schema, is that you're going to endorse that. That's going to lead you into endorse that liar is true just in case liar is not true. And so this gets you into a really big project in the technical literature on truth of how to give a reading for the conditional that might avoid allow you to endorse that biconditional, but avoid endorsing an outright contradiction, or else you're led to the view that you're going to endorse an outright contradiction. I'm not from Australia, so that's less appealing to me. So second issue, totally separate issue on the face of it. So you might think that the right response to the liar proposition is not to accept it, because that's going to lead to also denying it. And it's not to deny it, because that's going to lead to also accepting it. If you've got full intersubstitutability, that's the word you're going to have. And so you might think, we need to have some other attitude to have towards the liar proposition. We need to be able to reject it. That's got to be an alternative to accepting it and to denying it. We need to have this third attitude of rejection. And you might think, gosh, forget what your technical theory is. That's really what you should do. You just shouldn't accept the liar proposition. You shouldn't deny it. You should reject it instead. Similar question comes up. Are we able to give voice to this state of rejection? Are we able to make it explicit in some way? Is there some claim that we can make in the language that we can say something that gives voice to our state of rejecting a sentence? Okay, and so that's an interesting question. And I got interested by that question. And that question has to do with whether we can make explicit this particular state that we're in, insofar as we're responding in the appropriate way to the liar proposition. Okay, the problem is that and this is something that comes up in Mark Richard's 2008 book, When Truth Gives Out. Okay, so Richard thinks that there is this attitude of rejection. He calls it denial, this is the right attitude to have. Okay, and he thinks that there is a word in English. He thinks the word not is ambiguous in English between truth conditional not and rejection not. And rejection not is a way of giving voice to or expressing or making explicit the state of rejection that we might be in. The problem with this is that if you have a way of giving voice to the state of rejection, then straight away you can construct a revenge version of the paradox, a sentence which is going to give you a proposition that it's not going to make sense to accept it, it's not going to make sense to deny it, and it's not going to make sense to reject it either. You're going to need some fourth attitude. And Richard recognizes that. He just thinks that we don't have a word for that one, so we stop there. Okay, but we could have a word for that one in his view, in which case we get to construct a new revenge paradox, and we need a fifth attitude. Okay, and so this gets you into difficulties about revenge. Now I want to make two observations about both of these two questions. This question about the relationship between intersubstitutability and schema T, and about rejection. Okay, first observation is that both of these claims about what's going on in these cases have something to do with rationality or commitment relationships between mental states. The idea of full intersubstitutability is at bottom the claim that somebody who thinks that S means that P, and perhaps also that S doesn't have any conventional implicatures, is committed to having the same attitudes towards P and towards the claim that S is true. That's a claim about rational relationships between mental states. Okay. Similarly, the claim about rejection is the idea that some kind of diagnosis of what you do about paradoxical sentences, that you should reject them. That's the appropriate irrational response. That's the response that makes sense to have. That's also a claim about the rationality of mental states. That's a claim about what attitude it makes sense to have. Okay. Now, expressivism, insofar as it's a view that tries to explain what's going on in the meaning of language in general, okay, in terms of rational relationships between mental states, looks like it's particularly well suited to have something to say about these things. Second observation, second page of the handout, which I think is more significant. Both of these issues have to do with what kinds of mental states it is that it's possible to make explicit by there being sentences in the language that give voice to those states or that express them. In the case of the idea that schema T is somehow going to give voice to or express the state of conditional commitment that we're all in, it's one thing to describe the state of conditional commitment, to say, look, here's a predicament we're all in. The following condition applies to all of us, that we're conditionally committed to having the same attitudes toward P and towards the claim that S means that P. Conditionally, I'm thinking that S means that P. That's a claim about us. It describes us. It's another thing to think that that's something that we can give voice to by there being a sentence of language that expresses that. Similarly, the diagnosis of the liar says, look, reject it. It says, when you are in the state that involves the appropriate response to the liar, you're going to be rejecting it. That's a description of the state that we're in. It's one thing to be able to describe that state. It's another thing to be able to express it. So the idea that we're necessarily going to get some kind of paradox or revenge because we're going to be able to give voice to this state relies on the idea that just because we have the state that we're in, that's the appropriate response, there's going to be some terms in the language that allow us to give voice to it, to make it explicit. It's the ability to make it explicit that leads to the paradox of revenge. Okay. So what does this have to do with expressivism? Well, look, the distinction between reporting states of mind and expressing states of mind is a fundamental distinction that expressivism is founded on. Okay. That's one of the guiding ideas in the development of expressivism. And one of the things that people have discovered over the course of working on expressivism is that you can't hold that just any old state of mind is one that it's possible to express. That's too unconstrained. If you want to have a workable expressivist theory, you need to have some kind of constraints on which kinds of states of mind it's possible to express. So for example, in Thinking How to Live, Gibbard suggests that it's only states of mind that's possible to disagree with. This is actually quite familiar from the video, the film last night. But only possible states of mind that's possible to disagree with are ones that's possible to express by sentences. Okay. And in my 2008 book, I'm all summer 2008 philosophy of language books from Oxford University Press, being four, I articulate a version of expressivism, okay, which has even more robust constraints or what kind of states it's possible to express. Okay, and so the idea is that by thinking about truth within an expressivist framework, what you can do is you can shed some light on why it is that there might be certain states of mind that we don't need to be able to express, or perhaps that we can't express, and hence why we're going to be able to avoid having certain kinds of paradox. Okay. So the way I want to get into this is don't want to directly get into thinking about and talking about expressivism, but I want to take a detour. So where am I in the overall structure? I said I was going to shed some light on why expressivism might be a fruitful framework. I take it that I've done that in a cursory way, a way that I'm going to try and make good on over the rest of the talk. Okay. And now I'm going to talk about commitment theory, which is one of these two ideas that I want to introduce. Okay. The idea of commitment theory is, now commitment theory is neutral, I take it, between an expressivist framework and between a pure inferentialist framework. But the key idea of commitment theory is to just sit down and articulate what the commitment relationships or rational relationships should be between different sorts of mental state. Okay? And the idea is, if we're a pure inferentialist, I'll say more of this about in a bit, we might stop there. We might say, look, we're done. That's our theory of meaning. And if we're an expressivist, we accept that as a set of goals, the things that we want to explain. Okay? I'll say more about how to choose between those. So the idea of commitment theory is that we can stop and think. Suppose you think that you accept P, okay? You deny P, you reject P. How are those rationally related to one another? And how are they related to different attitudes, the same sorts of attitudes that you might have towards other sentences? For example, the claim that not P, okay? And I think there's a variety of plausible claims you can make about this. So if accepting P is like believing it, denying P is like believing its negation, then accepting the negation and denying P are going to be the same state. Okay, so they're going to be the same. Okay, and similarly, if rejection is just the state that involves some kind of refusal to accept or deny P, that's going to be the same as the state that's going to involve refusing to accept or deny not P. That's going to be the same state. Okay, and so in the course of thinking about what these states, this idea of acceptance, this idea of rejection, this idea of denial is, it's easy, I think, to come up with a set of possible rational relationships between them. Okay, and the way I actually understand these relationships is based on this primitive notion of disagreement they understand in Alan Gibbard's way. So the idea of disagreement is that two states of mind disagree with one another, just in case any two thinkers, one of whom is in one state and one of whom in the other state, would ipso facto disagree with one another. Okay, and I'm defining commitment in terms of disagreement. I'm taking it that acceptance, denial, and rejection are the only committed attitudes you could have towards something, so that if you disagree with accepting something and you disagree with denying it, you're committed to rejecting it. So you're committed to something insofar as you reject, you disagree with all the other possible attitudes towards that thing. Okay, that's the idea of what commitment is. Okay, and so from a relatively simple set of assumptions about the disagreement relationships between acceptance, denial, and rejection, it's possible to come up with what I call these commitment tables. And on the handout, I've got commitment tables for negation and for conjunction. And what those commitment tables do is they're not truth tables. They look a lot like truth tables. In fact, under different interpretation, they are truth tables. But I'm not interpreting them as truth tables. I'm interpreting them as what I call commitment tables. They don't tell us anything about some in-the-world truth values about propositions or sentences. All they tell us about is what states you're committed to being in, given that you're committed, you have these other attitudes. Okay, that's what the commitment tables are. Okay, there are a variety of ways of arriving at these two commitment tables. For example, if you adopt Hartree Fields' elucidation of rejection in Saving Truth from Paradox, where he has a suggestion that instead of thinking about degrees of belief as being governed by the principle that your degree of confidence in not P is 1 minus your degree of confidence in P, you adopt the principle that your degree of confidence in P and not P sums to at most 1. That's a generalization on thinking about degrees of belief. And then he defines rejection as having a degree of confidence of 0 in both P and not P. Acceptance is having a degree of confidence of 1 in P. Denial is having a degree of confidence of 0 in P. And 1 in not P. Okay. And that sort of framework is going to predict the exact same relationships that I've got specified on these tables. And I'm going to give a different explanation of them a little bit later. Okay. So the idea of commitment theory is that if we can articulate these relationships between these mental states, you can explain a lot about what it is to have thoughts with these contents. Okay, so if what is to think that P is to accept P, okay, there's a lot of things that we can explain. So one thing that we can explain is we can explain that all classical theorems are going to be undeniable. Okay, so given this commitment table for not and this commitment table for and, these are just the equivalent to the Strong-Kleene truth tables. And one of the facts about the Strong-Kleene truth tables is that classical all and only classical theorems don't have any D's in them. Okay, that's the idea that there's no consistent state of mind you can be in where you're not disagreeing with yourself. That's going to involve denying any classical theorem. And all and only classical theorems have that feature. Another fact that we can read off just from facts that we know from logic about the Strong-Kleene tables is we know that that modus ponens is going to preserve acceptance, or commitment to acceptance. Okay, so if you accept P, you accept if P then Q, you're going to be committed to accepting Q. Okay, so these are various features about the logic that we can explain, provided that we manage to explain these things that are captured in the commitment tables. Okay, so that's why I think about commitment theory as a useful intermediate stage in an expressivist theory or an inferential theory. It's a way of spelling out in a simplified way a powerful enough set of assumptions about what the rational relationships are between different states that we can use that in order to explain logical and semantic properties of the sentences that express those states. That's the idea of commitment theory. Okay. And so on the bottom of the second page of the handout, I've got another commitment table. This one's a little bit more complicated. If the whole one's not on here, the full commitment table would have to involve all the different possible values for P and for S. Okay. But the idea is that just like we can explain the logical or semantic properties of conjunction and negation and of other truth conditional compounds by looking at commitment tables for them, we can explain the semantic features of a truth predicate by looking at a commitment table for claims about truth. And so this is about the sentential truth predicate. And the thought is that what you want is you want to turn out that somebody who has different attitudes towards P and towards the claim that S is true is committed to denying that S means that P. Okay, that's what you want the commitment table to capture. And so what I did is I drew a commitment table that captures exactly that. It shows that that as long as you accept or reject the claim that S means that P, you're committed. You have the same attitudes towards the claim that S is true and towards P. And if you don't have those same attitudes towards the claim that S is true and towards P, then the only thing that's left is you have to deny that S means that P. Okay, and so that's what the commitment table does, is it just summarizes what those relationships are between being in those three different kinds of states of mind. There's really nine states of mind. There's three attitudes towards each of the claims that I have on there. Okay, and so one of the virtues of this commitment table is that you can explain why it is that every instance of the T schema, including the Lyra instance, is going to be rationally undeniable. So if the T schema says that if S means that P, then S is true just in case P, and we define the material conditional and the material biconditional in terms of the of conjunction and negation, and so they've got the same commitment properties that arise from that, if you think that S means that P, since we know that the if you deny the T schema, then you're going to think that S means that P, and that S is true just in case P. Sorry, it's not the case that S is true just in case P. Okay, so you're going to deny the that biconditional. Okay, and that's going to have to involve having different attitudes towards S is true and towards P. Okay, so we can explain why it is that the T schema does have a special status, not that we have to accept all of its instances, but that we can't deny any of its instances. And that's exactly the same status that classical theorems had. Not that we're committed to any of them in every instance, okay, but that we're committed to all of them insofar as as long as we accept excluded middle for all the atoms that are involved. Okay, I can say them a little bit stronger than that, but it's more complicated. Okay. So where are we? So the big question is, commitment theory is a way of talking about the rational relationships between mental states that has that sort of summarizes lots of information in an accessible way that we can manipulate and do lots of things with, including predicting various kinds of logical and semantic properties. So if we have commitment theory on board, if that's something we have, then we can explain lots of these semantic and logical properties. That sounds great. So the question is, why not stop here? Why not say, look, now I've got my theory about what conjunction and negation mean and what the truth predicate means. It's given by these commitment tables. Okay? I think there's two ways of thinking about this. If you stop there and you say the theory is given directly by the commitment tables, then I think you're a pure inferentialist. That's what I would think of as a pure inferential strategy. Okay? A pure expressivist strategy, in contrast, is going to try and give a story, okay, about what it is to accept, deny, and reject each of the claims that are involved in each of these things. And then it's going to explain why you get these commitment tables on the basis of that story. So instead of helping itself to there being these various commitment relationships and disagreement relationships, it's going to explain, using an underlying story about what the underlying mental states are, why it is that they're going to be involved in those commitment and disagreement relationships. Okay? And so there are two differences between these two pictures, I think. And so one important difference, I think, is that the expressivist picture has the potential, insofar as we take this slow track, okay, that we stop and we walk through and we figure out what the mental states are, and then we use features of those mental states to explain their rational relationships to one another. This is the kind of thing that Simon was doing in Spreading the Word in 1984, was giving a substantive, constructive story about what the state was, and then using substantive assumptions about those states to explain their rational relationships to one another. Okay, and the virtue of that is that it yields some constraints. Okay, and I think constraints are good. Okay, I think that healthy theories generate constraints. Okay, and I think that constraints are now enable us to explain things that we should want to be able to explain. And the whole idea of getting started on thinking about expressivism in terms of truth was about whether we might generate some constraints, whether it might turn out that we could explain why it is that there are some mental states that we're not able to make explicit or to articulate or to express. Okay, and so insofar as if you generate some constraints, it doesn't just say, hey, let's just say that we want this complex state, thinking that it's true, that this is true, to have these certain inferential properties, but we need to explain those properties. We're going to need to do that in a constrained way, and there might not be just that any old set of properties is one that's possible for this complex state to have. Okay, and that's one of the fundamental guiding ideas. And then, of course, I think that there is a virtue to honest toil over theft. So I won't say more about that. So this brings us to expressivism. Here's how I think about an expressivist semantics. So the way I think about it, the idea of an expressivist semantics is a kind of assertability conditional semantics. Okay, the idea is that just as syntax gives you a set of rules that are permissibility rules, but not outright permissibility rules, they're sort of syntactic permissibility rules. It's okay to say a sentence as far as syntax goes if you've obeyed those rules. Okay, and morphology does the same thing. It says it's okay to say something insofar as morphology goes, but maybe it goes wrong with syntax. I think that it's fruitful to think of semantics as giving an analogous set of rules, a set of rules, the semantic rules, that tell you that it's okay to assert the sentence as far as semantics goes, maybe not okay for pragmatic reasons, but it's kind of permissibility rules. Okay, and I think these permissibility rules aren't truth conditions. Okay, I don't think that's not a helpful way to think about it, because if you think of somebody who really believes, for example, that Hillary Clinton is president of the United States, and you ask her who's president of the United States, and she says Hillary Clinton is president of the United States, she doesn't seem to me like she's broken the rules of the language. She's made a mistake, but her mistake is about electoral politics in the US, not about the language. Okay, and so it's fruitful to think of these semantic rules as rules about that tell you, look, it's okay to assert a sentence, quote, P, just in case you think that P. That'd be a little bit more complicated than that, but that's a rough gloss. Okay, so an expressivist semantics, the way I conceive of it, is going to try and work in this way. For each sentence P, that's going to try and tell you what it is to think that P. Okay, and then it's going to go back to commitment theory, and it's going to try and having given the set of compositional rules that explains what it is for each sentence P to think that P, that's step one of the goals, we're going to use that in order to explain why it is that these states accepting something, rejecting it, denying it, are involved in the commitment relationships that they are, okay, as specified in commitment theory. And then we'll read off of commitment theory the logical and semantic properties of the sentences. Okay, and I sort of hinted at how that would go earlier. Okay. So that's sort of what the goal is. The goal is that you need to give some compositional story that tells you what mental state is expressed by complex sentences in some way that's determined by their parts. And then you want to use that substantive story, that constructive story, to predict and explain the relationships between them that are specified in commitment theory. Okay? And I think that can be done to a certain extent. And so here's an idea for how it goes. My suggestion for how we do this involves stepping back for a minute and thinking about the relationship between an expressivist or pragmatist theory and the notion of a proposition. Okay, so one of the things that Hugh suggested yesterday is that we should think of these, there being two different notions of representation. My suggestion is that we think of there as being two different notions of proposition. Okay, and not just that we have a thin sense of proposition and a thick sense of proposition, where our theory appeals to the thick sense of proposition. And one of the things we do in our theory is we earn the right to use the word proposition in a thin sense. I think that's fine. But I think there's a lot of theoretical work that kind of thin sense of proposition can't do, that it would be useful to have something that our theory actually appeals to in order to do those things. Okay? But it wouldn't do to identify that sense of proposition with exactly whatever it is that we got worried about when we got worried about whether we could be representationalist or not in this domain. So I think what we need to do is we need to distinguish between two different sets of theoretical roles that propositions have traditionally been held to play. So one set of theoretical roles is associated with their role as being the objects of the attitudes and the bearers of truth and falsity. They're the things that you believe, assert, wonder, say, okay, and they're true and false. That's one set of roles. Now, people also associate a lot of other roles with propositions, at least in many parts of philosophy. Okay, they're taking it to be in some way correspond to some kind of metaphysical commitment, maybe to play a role in carving up the world. Okay, so maybe in Hugh's notion of e-worlds, they're taken to there's some stronger notion of how it is that they're carving up reality. Okay, and maybe they're taken to be something that it makes, along with those, it perhaps makes sense to think of them as being the appropriate objects of excluded middle, insofar as excluded middle is appropriate. The idea being that if there's a world, the world's got to be some way. Okay, and so insofar as they are making genuine, carving up the world in genuine ways, they've got to be that way or they've got to not be that way. Okay. Now, there are a variety of reasons why you might think that those two sets of rules go together. Okay, I'm not going to get into all of them, but I think that it's very fruitful if you're a non-descriptivist to instead of rejecting propositions wholesale because you don't go for the latter, something that plays the latter role in your specific domain, to carve these up and hold that they're helped play by two different classes of entities. That maybe there's one class of entities that plays this role in carving up reality, and that when you're committed to entities of that kind in a certain domain that involves some kind of metaphysical commitment, and that those are the appropriate objects of excluded middle. But propositions, insofar as they're the objects of the attitudes and the bearers of truth and falsity, might simply be a different kind of thing. And so the picture that I'm going to spell out, that I think is an expressivist view, has that structure. That's one way of thinking about it, is that it's going to hold that propositions are one kind of thing, and these things that are problematic from the point of view of a non-representationalist, okay, a non-descriptivist, non-factualist, those are a different sort of thing. Okay. Now, this raises an important question. How is it that, say, if we're going to have any kind of bifurcation, how is it that an ordinary descriptive belief can both have a proposition, that propositions can be objects of ordinary descriptive beliefs, and that ordinary descriptive beliefs can play a role in mapping out the world and carving up distinctions in reality? Okay. And I think, well, look, here's how. Being about to go to Paris is a relation to Paris, but it's also a relation to going to Paris. It depends on where you carve it up. If you think about it as a relation to Paris, there's the same relation might you hold to London, or to Taipei, or to Buenos Aires. Okay, and so you might think of the various places that you're about to go. Okay, but you might also think of this relation of being about to, where go to Paris is the object of that relation in this case. And you can be about to go to London, go to Taipei, go to Buenos Aires, But you can also be about to brush your teeth, or about to throw up, or about to storm out of the conference venue. And so there are various things that you can be about to do that aren't cases of going someplace and aren't relations to a place at all. Okay, so the thought is, look, if ordinary descriptive belief has this sort of structure, okay, that you, it could be a relation to different things depending on how you carve it up, then one way of carving it up could be a relation to this notion of proposition that's more general. Like a thing you might do, going someplace, brushing your teeth, there's lots of possibilities for what that might be. Okay, those are like propositions. They're the objects of the attitudes, the bearers of truth and falsity. You can understand belief, desire, assertion, intention as relations to those things in an ordinary way. Okay, but when you carve it the other way, there's this important class of beliefs, of desires, okay, that you can carve up this other way. You can carve them up as the place that you're about to go to. And so places are like what I call representational contents. They're like these things that correspond to some kind of metaphysical commitment that we're skeptical about in certain domains insofar as we like some kind of non-representationalism. Okay, so that's the diagram. It's like a descriptive case on the left on the handout that shows how we can carve up descriptive belief in two different ways. And one of those is fully general, applies to all beliefs. Okay, now that's just a very abstract picture. And so the actual expressivist view that I'm going to spell out in the last little bit has that structure. I think that's a fruitful way of thinking about its structure. Okay. So the first thing, so now I'm on section 2.2, bifurcated attitudes. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to give a view of propositions that's going to have this structure. And it's going to basically involve a view of belief that's going to explain how it is that ordinary descriptive belief has this two-tiered structure that we can carve it up in two different places, and that's going to correspond to a more general notion of belief that doesn't always have that two tiers. It just has one of them. Okay. But my picture is going to be a little bit more complicated than the picture for the following reason. Insofar as what we want to do is we want to explain the commitment tables, and insofar as you accept my suggestion that we didn't really have time to walk through carefully, that the commitment table should have the structure of the Strong-Kleene truth tables. Okay, there's something we know about what gives rise to the Strong-Kleene tables. The Strong-Kleene tables are given rise to when you have a bifurcated structure. If you think of the top value as true and not false, the middle value as not true and not false, the bottom value as false and not true. If you think of the top value as P is known and not P is not known, the middle value as P is not known and not P is not known, and the bottom value as not P is known and P is not known. These different bifurcated structures give rise to the Strong-Kleene table. In fact, this is why Hartree Fields' picture of rejection gives rise to the view, where I told you that his view, his picture is that acceptance is having a full credence of one in P, credence of zero in not P. Rejection is having credence of zero in P, credence of zero in not P. And denial is having credence of one in not P, credence of zero in P. All of these that gives rise to the structure rise from a bifurcated structure. Okay, so I'm going to give a bifurcated picture of belief, and that's going to give rise to this structure. Okay, and so to create the bifurcation, I need the constituents. Okay, and I'm going to appeal in articulating the constituents to this attitude that I call being for. Okay, you can fill in whatever notion you want. Okay, the idea is just that this notion of being for, I think of it as a motivational state. Okay, it's not like a special kind of belief, and so it can be a constituent of non-cognitive attitudes without them reducing to belief. Okay. I think of it as taking properties just because I think of things you do as being properties of agents. Okay? And so if you're for some property, okay, then that's the kind of thing that might motivate you to do that. Okay? That's just helpful for thinking about it, I think. But the most important assumption I need to make about the attitude being for is that it shares a certain property with belief and intention. So belief and intention both have this feature that if you believe one thing and you believe an inconsistent thing, then you're in this state of self-disagreement, that what Gilbert would call self-disagreement. It's a special kind of inconsistency that you're in that I'm using the word disagreement for. Okay, and that's not true of lots of other attitudes. It's not true of desire. It's not true of wondering. It's not true of assuming. Okay, but it's true of belief. It's true of intention. Some people think it's true of intention because intention involves belief. Okay, I think that's probably not right. But insofar as I think there's grounds to be optimistic that there are going to be desire-like attitudes that are going to bear disagreement relationships to one another, I think our grounds for optimism should be based on there being a state that exhibits similar kinds of behavior in terms of disagreement to the kinds of behavior that other states that involve disagreement exhibit, namely belief and intention. Those are the paradigms of states that we can disagree with one another by being those sorts of states. Okay? So the idea is that being for has exactly this minimal property that seems fair to assume that some state might have. Okay? Propositions are going to consist in pairs of properties, okay, that namely pairs of the kinds of things to be arguments to states of being for, okay, with the following condition, that one is strictly stronger than the other. So in my book, I assume only that one's at least as strong as the other. For reasons that might come out today, I'm assuming that it's strictly stronger. It doesn't change a lot, okay? But the idea is that you believe a proposition when you're for each property in the pair. Okay, so to believe a proposition is to be in this joint for relation to the pair, to be for each of the properties. Okay, and now right away we can, I want to explain two more things. Okay, so here's an example of a pair of properties, one of which is strictly stronger than the other. The property of avoiding stealing and disapproving of stealing is one property, and the property of disapproving of stealing is the other property. Okay. One is strictly stronger because avoiding stealing and disapproving of it is not entailed by disapproving of it, but disapproving is entailed by avoiding it and disapproving of it. Okay, so that's an example. This gives you a picture of how, so to believe this proposition is to be for each member, that is to be for avoiding disapproving of stealing and for disapproving of stealing. What's somebody who's in that state going to do? Well, being for is a motivational state. It's going to move them, other things equal, to avoid and disapprove of stealing and to disapprove of stealing. This sounds a lot like the sort of thing that a non-cognitivist expressivist in metaethics might say, okay? So this is the sort of picture. This is a kind of belief on this view, but this it looks paradigmatically like a sort of non-cognitive attitude, like you might see in a non-cognitivist expressivist theory, okay? Got like eight minutes, I think. So let me say something about ordinary descriptive belief. Okay, which is at the top of page 4 of the handout. So far what I've given is I've given a picture of what the non-descriptive case looks like, the general case, the case that applies to ordinary descriptive belief and applies to every other kind of belief, including moral beliefs, okay, or beliefs about truth, or beliefs about conditionals. Okay, how are we going to understand ordinary descriptive belief in this framework? What relation to these things, representational contents, things that cover up reality, could there be that would fit into this picture? And here's a gloss. One thing you might do in relation to these things that carve up reality, that play some role in metaphysical commitment, is you might take them as settled in deciding what to do. Okay, you might take it as settled that the world is a certain way in deciding what you're going to do. Okay, and that's a relation that I call proceeding as if, or PAI for short. Okay, and I think that if you're taking P as settled and deciding what to do, you're not also taking not P as settled and deciding what to do. You can't do both. You can't both take one thing as settled and deciding what to do and take the other thing as settled and deciding what to do. And if that's right, then for every representational content, everything that carves up reality, these things you might think of them as propositions in this other sense of proposition, okay? There is the following pair of properties. The property of proceeding as if it, and the property of not proceeding as if not it, okay? And that's a proposition on this view because the first is strictly stronger than the latter, okay? So if that's right, then that's a natural candidate to identify with the descriptive proposition, okay? It fits into the same framework, and what does somebody who believes one of these descriptive propositions do? What kind of state are they in? Well, they're in a state that's gonna lead them to take the proposition in the narrow sense as settled and deciding what to do. Okay? That's not a totally unintuitive picture about what belief is like. Okay? So here's at least a rough gloss on a structural picture that has the features articulated in the diagram on the previous page of the handout. It's got this descriptive case that's a special case, that's like being about to go someplace. And that's understood in terms of a more general case of being about to do something. Okay, so the thought is, look, once you've got this structure, lots of things become easy. Okay, We can do compositional semantics on propositions, these things that apply all the way across the board. So for example, here's it's really simple. For any pair of properties, there's a pair that consists of the negations of each, and that's also going to be a proposition. Okay, so that is going to, we'll just define that to be the negation. Okay, and for any two pairs of properties, one of which is stronger than the other, we can define the pair that consists of the conjunctions of the stronger members and the conjunctions of the weaker members. That's also going to satisfy the definition of a proposition. Okay, we'll just define that to be the conjunction. And now it turns out that that we can explain the commitment tables for negation and conjunction just appeal to these simple assumptions about what negated and conjunctive propositions are. Okay? And the facts, and the single assumption that we made about being four, that two states of being four disagree with each other just in case their objects are inconsistent. Okay? That's all we need. I'd walk through this except for the time constraints, but that's all we need in order to explain the commitment tables. And so that's a simple assumption. It's the kind of assumption that it feels like we ought to be able to help ourselves to, or at least be optimistic we'd be able to explain about some sort of desire-like state, like being four, because that's the kind of thing that's true about belief and about intention. So insofar as we should be optimistic that the kinds of things that can be true about belief and intention could also be true about some other state. In fact, for all I've said, being four is intention. Okay. We should be optimistic that we can have the resources to explain in a substantive way all of these commitment tables. Okay. So very briefly, back to truth. Question is, like, why would you think of these pairs of properties as being propositions? Why is that an appropriate way of thinking about them? Sure, there's this semantic trick that that in order to give a story about what it is to accept a conjunction or what it is to accept a negation, this extra level of structure helped with that. But why think that those are really propositions? And I think, well, here's why. Insofar as proposition, the idea of proposition is this theoretical rule of being the object of the attitudes and the bearers of truth and falsity, we'll believe that they're propositions insofar as we, in our theory, we've got some things that play the role of objects of the attitudes and bearers of truth and falsity. Okay? And that's the role that these pairs of properties can play in this sort of theory. So if you think of that as a kind of term-forming operator, that's going to pick out the pair of properties that is associated with the complement clause, okay? And you can think of thinks and means, for example, I have a rough story in the handout, okay, as ordinary descriptive predicates, okay, that express ordinary descriptive beliefs whose contents are the appropriate ones in order for this to work out, okay? And similarly for truth. But we're not going to think of truth on this picture as a descriptive property. We're not going to think of thinking that something is true as a state of ordinary descriptive belief. Okay? The idea is that we can have an essentially expressivist theory of truth insofar as we give a story about what it is, about what truth propositions are, what it is to think that something is true, okay, that doesn't have this proceeding as if structure, that has the more general structure, that it's on the right-hand side of that diagram. Okay, and the thought is just, well, what would that be? What are you motivated to do insofar as you think that something is true? Well, if thinking that something is true is if the true is a predicate of a pair of propositions, a pair of properties, okay, something you might be motivated to do with respect to that pair is to instantiate its stronger member and instantiate its weaker member. Okay, well, instantiate the stronger member of a pair is a stronger property than instantiating the weaker member of a pair. So instantiating the stronger, the pair of the properties of instantiating the stronger member and instantiating the weaker member satisfies the definition of a proposition. It's a pair of properties, one of which is strictly stronger. So if thinking that something is true is being for instantiating its stronger member and being for instantiating its weaker member, then that's an essentially expressivist theory about propositional truth. Okay? It doesn't make it out to be an ordinary descriptive belief. Okay, but it fits into the same general framework, and so all your compositional story works in exactly the same way. Okay, very briefly, once we have this, I think we can define sentential. And once we have quantifiers, which I didn't talk about, but I think don't present big complications, we can define sentential truth in terms of this propositional truth. Okay, and that's what's going to predict the commitment table for sentential truth from the second page of the handout. Okay, and so when we have that sort of picture, then we can explain why it is that that we have full interceptability without having without needing to or feeling like there's a special need to endorse the T schema unrestrictedly. We'll say something weaker about the T schema, that it's undeniable in all of its instances, but we won't accept it. And we have an explanation of why you can't make explicit rejection. The reason you can't make explicit rejection is that rejection is having the weak, accepting the weaker member of P and accepting the weaker member of not P. And you're guaranteed, given that P always consists of a pair of properties, one of which is strictly stronger, and that not P always consists of a pair of properties, one of which is strictly stronger. Okay, in fact, there's the negations of the properties in P. You're guaranteed for it to turn out that accepting the weaker members is never accepting each of a pair of properties, one of which is strictly stronger. Neither one is going to be stronger than the other. It won't be a proposition. And so this account has the virtue of being able to say why it is that we can't give voice to rejection. Okay, why it is that we're not going to be able to construct one of these paradoxes of revenge with respect to just the mere ability to express rejection. Okay, and also to cut, because we have the distinction between propositions and representational contents, we can take advantage of some of the virtues of the view according to which what's the reason why we shouldn't be worried about the liar is that it doesn't express a proposition without its costs. The costs of that view are that people do have attitudes towards liar propositions, so it seems like we really need to have propositions. Okay? But the virtues of that view is that it seems to explain why it is that it's okay to neither accept it nor deny it. Okay? You don't need to accept it, you don't need to deny it, because there's no question there. That's what the no propositions view can say. Okay? Well, this view has two senses of propositions. So the sense in which there's got to be some fact of the matter, okay, that's the idea of propositions as representational contents, the appropriate objects of excluded middle. There does have to be got to be some fact of the matter about the world. But truth isn't about the world. Okay? There doesn't have to be any fact of the matter about it. There's nothing we miss out on by not accepting or denying a claim about truth. I'm going on. Anyway, that's it.
People, please keep your hands up for me.
Okay, so certainly for anybody who's going to give a non-classical approach to the liar, so a fair complete or a fair consistent approach, you're going to want some account of the difference between acceptance and denial versus rejection.
Yeah.
And then it is an interesting issue as to whether you can lexicalize rejection.
Yeah.
That's one route to revenge paradoxes, absolutely. There's certainly other routes, though, and so one question is, I didn't get a definition of validity in here. You say, in other words, our account of logic together with the account of truth allows us to earn the right to say that valid arguments are truth-preserving. So the first question is, what's validity? And then the second one is the point about not missing out on anything by rejecting the liar proposition. Not about the world, but something that, say, Kripke's made a big point of is that there are contingent liar propositions. His example is most of Nixon's claims about Watergate are false, right? Usually, in lots of cases, that's not going to be paradoxical, but there are cases in which it will turn out to be paradoxical, and for the most part, speakers in a conversation aren't going to have access to whether that thing turns out to be paradoxical.
Right.
It makes sense to think of that as having representational content. And so I'm wondering about this claim at the end, this they're not about the world claim, given contingent liars.
Absolutely. So that was really a separate question. So the first question is about validity.
That's right.
And particularly in connection with the offhand remark on the handout that I didn't get a chance to talk about, where I said there was this virtue of the kind of truth that it lets you earn the right to the claim that valid arguments are preserving in a sense. And so that relies on the definition of validity that you get if you think that what you're trying to do is to preserve classical logic, and you're trying to think, well, what are the classical validities in this framework? They're the ones where the material conditional, if P then Q, is classically valid. So we can get those based on the things that are undeniable. So we can define validity in that way. If the aim is to get classical validity, we can define it in that way. And those are the things that, given the theory of truth, we can sort of, we can do this earning the right thing.
So you get a strong leading logic then on it?
What's that?
You get a strong leading definition of validity?
No.
That you,
but it's unintuitive in a lot of ways, because it's defined in terms of the things, basically the things that if you accept the premises, you're committed to not denying the conclusion, not the things that if you accept the premises, you're committed to accepting the conclusion. And so it's a weird thing to call validity. But it's, if what you want to do if the idea is to be conservative with respect to logic in some way, and you like classical logic, those are the things that are the classical validities in this system. So if you think that's a weird thing to call validity, if you think that validity should be the things where if you accept the premises, you're committed to accepting the conclusion, then you don't get the classical validities. And I don't want to say the thing I said there without thinking more about how that works.
Good.
Okay. So the thing about contingent liar is, I totally agree. In fact, I think there's this naive response to the liar that says, look, there's no proposition. And I think that two things go wrong with that. First of all, the contingent liar, where it's unclear how there could be no proposition and there could come to be a proposition as weird things happen. But the other thing that is even more straightforward is that in contingent liar cases, I mean, I took mine off the handout, I had one earlier, but that it's very clear that some people can think that they're true, can think they're not. Saul Kripke might believe that the only sentence written on the whiteboard in Hartree Fields' office is not true, based on what he takes to be inductive evidence, and that might be the only sentence written on the whiteboard in Hartree Fields' office. But we all agree, because we talked to Kripke, that he really does think that the only, and we know that's the only thing written on the whiteboard. So I think that you can't deny that there are propositions. I think it's very implausible, but I think that if you distinguish between propositions understood as the objects of the attitudes and the birds of truth and falsity, and this other role for propositions of carving up the world, then I think you get an explanatory story about this Kleene-based response to the paradoxes, which is that first of all, you've got the sentences about the claims about the world, and if we've got X to the middle for those, the world's got to be some way. Then you're missing out on something if you reject any of those. And so just rejecting one doesn't solve anything. You're just missing out on something, and you've got to admit that. Okay. But then there's sentences of the form is true that P. Okay. And those aren't themselves about the world. They're not descriptive, but they're linked to descriptive ones because of these commitment relationships that I can predict and explain. And so basically, the grounded sentences are going to be ones that, in rejecting them, you're going to be committed to missing out to rejecting something about the world, and hence you'll be committed to missing out on something. And the ungrounded ones, you're not going to be committed to missing out on anything about the world. And so the contingent liar is contingently ungrounded. And so that's the... So I actually think that this is part of a diagnosis of what's going on in those cases. I don't know if I believe this diagnosis. It has the appealing features of the no propositions response that I think is very naive and doesn't work, but it doesn't have the costs because there's a real option to the attitudes. Kripke really does believe that the only sentence written in Hartree Fields' office is not true. Because he really does stand in that relation to that proposition. There really is that proposition. That's the...
Rachel.
So here's an interesting difference between your commitment tables and truth tables.
Yeah.
If I've got a Kleene truth table, and I know, and I've got some compound sentence, and I sort of look at the column for that compound sentence, and I've got a truth value picked out for it, then I know something about the truth values of its parts. So if it's true that P and Q, then it's got to be true that P, and it's got to be true that Q. sense over commitment table. So if I'm committed to P or Q, then I may not be committed to P, I may not be committed to Q. So that's a difference, and I'm wondering if this is going to make a sort of inferential difference for you that might be a bit of a problem. But I haven't quite worked it out. So the naive thought is that feature of truth tables is really useful for things like disjunctive syllogism. And maybe there's a similar feature of quantifiers that's useful for performing natural deductions where you you have an existentially quantified sentence and then you assume that you've got something that satisfies the sentence. You sort of introduce the thing, prove some stuff, take it out again. So I'm wondering if there's going to be a problem with that kind of inference that results from that feature of commitment tables.
There might be. I don't see it yet. I don't know. I need to think more about that. I think it's a great question, actually.
Rachel, I've got a rather long queue, so I think I'd prefer to cut that question off here and move on and encourage everyone to be brief if possible. Matthew, your name.
A couple questions about being poor. First, on the theft of honest toil, in articulating this theory, are you committed to sort of an empirical claim about the existence of these states of being poor, or are you just helping yourself to that in this attempt to give an explanation from types of states of mind to the logic?
So I don't take myself to be defending this theory.
Is that something that would have to be done?
I think it's reasonable to start with this structural idea that here's the kind of thing. Gibbard makes a big deal in Thinking How to Live about appealing to explanatory materials of the kind that things that everybody else is going to need to explain. So he's got some unexplained things about disagreement, but he thinks those are the same descriptivists. Everybody's got to explain the same things. I think the principle is right, but the application is not right. I think he appeals to lots of things that other views don't have to be able to explain. And so this idea about being for being a state that has this feature is the kind of thing that's on a par with what everybody needs to explain about belief and about intention. And so the idea is that it's at least the kind of thing to be optimistic about being able to explain. I don't think it's going to be a good hypothesis about natural language unless there is some state that is structurally like this. And there'll be lots of differences. So you do the same stuff if being for, you think of it as being like proposition, having proposition-like objects instead of property-like objects. You can get the same stuff if it's negative. There's lots of variations you have on the structure, on how to fill out the structure, the same features. But there needs to be something about the structure that is empirically adequate in order for this to be a good hypothesis about natural language, I think.
Can I follow up, Mike?
I would prefer that you didn't. Mike.
So in thinking that P is true, you ask, what am I motivated to do?
Yeah.
So just a quick puzzle for me. Thinking that P is true, shouldn't I be motivated to do whatever I'm motivated to do in thinking that P?
Yeah. So when you think that P, you're motivated to, there's two things you're motivated to do. So thinking that P is true is being motivated to have the property of being motivated to do each of those things, so to do those things.
I guess I'm worried about the relationship. Once you accept that, I'm now puzzled about why it is that we're so confident that truth is always not descriptive. Because if thinking that P is a descriptive proposition as you defined it, right? Mm-hmm. Then it seems to me that descriptivity should sort of carry over to thinking that P is true.
Well, there's two ways we can talk about descriptivity, right? So one way we can talk about descriptivity is we can say, just look at the structure of the state, like to see whether it, looks like this or like this, okay? And so on that way of doing it, the truth beliefs aren't, they're on this side, okay? Another way of doing it is we might look at whether they are committing us to taking a stand about things that are like this, and that will give us a broader notion of descriptive. And if the truth predicate is the only non-descriptive predicate in the language, then all but the ungrounded propositions are going to come out in that broader class, and the ungrounded ones won't. But if we've got other terms in our language, like we've got moral predicates, and those express attitudes like, I had it on here somewhere, that like the one, the example I gave for thinking that stealing is wrong, then propositions about their truth won't be descriptive in the broader sense either. So I think there is a broader sense we can define, but it's not going to be universal, even if the truth predicate is the only predicate, because it won't work for the ungrounded ones. And if we've got other predicates that receive an essentially expressivist interpretation, then truth ascribed to those isn't going to be descriptive in this broader sense either.
Jamie.
Another question about the divorce in section 2.1.
Yeah.
So I take it you think the expressivists should say that there can be propositions that bear truth and falsity even though they don't carve out reality or make any metaphysical commitments.
I'm going to say that they're the bearers of truth and falsity. So they're the things that are figure as arguments in the predicates truth and falsity.
Okay, so and they can do that even though they don't play role number two here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, the typical reason people don't want to make this divorce is because you want to give an account of why things bear truth or falsity in virtue of what their relationship is to the world.
And oh yeah. So the thought is that if you have fullness of suitability, the liar is serious trouble for answering that question. And so that's actually one of the motivations, is to not answer the question of what is in virtue of which things are true that aspires to be fully general account, but to instead attack the question of understanding truth, not by saying what truth is, but by saying what is to think that something is true. That's the general move. So there's a competing view on which you want to give an answer to that question. But I take it the spirit of this view precisely to get off that boat.
Okay,
I'll have to go on this
point. That's not
going to work. Yeah. Crispin. Just to try and get a bit clearer on the notion of lexicalization. I thought I understood as you went through and then I lost.
The notion of what?
Lexicalization.
Yeah.
What was just a lexicalize an attitude? So trying to suppose you thought there was an attitude of denying a proposition, an attitude expressed by denying a proposition.
An attitude of denying.
Well, that's lexicalizing, because it's something I can accept or affirm, and thereby the expression of that attitude, then the negation of the proposition. Okay. Then the thought is, well, there's nothing I can, there's no proposition I can affirm, which by affirming it, I give expression to rejection in the same way.
Yeah.
I can, of course, report my rejection.
Yeah.
I reject the last sentence. But now to understand the notion, if that's the right way of glossing the notion, then it's crucial to get the contrast from the start to expressing and affirming. That's got to be very robust. Future explanation. If I don't have that and want instead to use the notion of lexicalization to get back to that expression.
Sorry, if I don't have the difference between saying that I'm in a state.
So suppose I'm someone who doesn't understand robustly expressivist and primitive the notion of expression of an attitude as opposed to primitive attitude.
Good. I don't take it as a primitive. So I think that to express an attitude is to utter a sentence purporting to be following the rules of the language such that sentence has that attitude as its assertability condition. So I think that you use assertability conditional semantics to explain the notion of expression. I think that's the argument in my paper Expression for Expressiveness in the first part of the book, that I think it's not satisfactory to have a primitive unexplained notion of expression. I think that alternative views about the expression relation have some deep problems. And so I would try to explain it in that general way. It's not individualistic or Brecht-ian. There are lots of other pictures about what it might be. But it's something that we can only understand intra-theoretically in terms of the structure of the theory of uncertainty and conditional semantics.
I would follow.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question, and I'm going to give it to myself. You just characterize a view as kind of wanting to get off a particular kind of boat. And I think from my perspective, it looks like you've taken one step off the boat, but left one foot on the boat.
Okay.
What I'm interested in is, well, let me first try and characterize that in terms of your distinction between the two roles for the notion of proposition. I mean, I think I want to say that the second role is entirely derivative from the first role, at least if we understand sort of metaphysics and reality in what I was calling the I-world sense. So we kind of get our sense of the facts from the fact that we committed to propositions in the first sense. What my question is, and this may just reveal something that I haven't understood about your program yet, is there something in the program which prevents someone from using it for that extra step?
I was thinking about this the other day because Diane Millman asked me the same thing. And I think there is something in the program that prevents the extra step. So the way that the explanation of the disagreement properties of states of being equal works is it adverts to stuff about their contents. And so this looks like it is getting us up to, working us up to this theory insofar as we can take the contents of states of being four as only involving the non-essentially expressivist stuff, the constituents from the world. So I do think that that's a constraint, is that it gets the explanatory power by taking the attitudes that are strictly about the world in this narrow sense.
Okay.
And then explain how you can construct attitudes that are more general out of that.
Good. I was sort of hoping that it would be the answer because, I mean, it kind of locates the issue where I was inclined to think it should be concerning the kind of origin of the primitive notion of incompatibility, whether you have to kind of locate it in sort of in a metaphysical place or whether you can construct it entirely from something like a kind of incompatibility between practical attitudes or something like that. The kind of something that a global expressivist like me can feed into the program.
See, I'm not sure that I want to think about it as metaphysical. I guess it is metaphysical insofar as once you have to have these, there's some metaphysics.
Yeah.
But I don't think the explanation is primarily metaphysical. What I think the key virtue of the explanation to be is that you explain lots of disagreement relationships by appeal to one simple assumption about the disagreement properties of an attitude. And my concern about various kinds of expressivist approaches is that they help themselves to disagreement relationships between different attitudes that end up amounting to a long list, in fact, an infinite list in some cases, of primitive assumptions about those disagreement relationships. And so the virtue of this is that it's getting you down to a thinner set of assumptions about the mind.
Okay, good. I mean, I think the one thing you want to leave room for in this picture is cases in which, the disagreement isn't coming from within the attitudes to which the expressivist story is imposed. It's rather the other way around. For example, the example I mentioned yesterday of moving from booing and cheering to expressing one's attitudes in terms of that's good, that's bad. I think precisely one of the things that does is to impose an incompatibility structure on people's commitments across them before. By putting the expressions in the form of commitments, we make it the case that if somebody boos and somebody cheers, then what they've done is seen to be incompatible in a way in which it wasn't before. The function of the asatoric vocabulary in some of the interesting cases, I think this is particularly clear in the probability case. If you sort of start from credences, we can quite properly have different credences about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if we come to express our credences by talking about probabilities, then it will seem that our credences conflict.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a good thing because we now feel the pressure to agree. If that's the right sort of story about what's going on, the disagreement is being posed from outside rather than existing in the attitudes at the beginning. And I think it's important that the story should leave room for that kind of possibility.
Okay.
One of the things the picture I gave, I think, doesn't answer very clearly is what the relationship is between the intrapersonal disagreement relationships, which were all I was really appealing to, and disagreeing with somebody else, and how that arises. And that's one of the puzzles for me about the view, is whether that comes along naturally or there's extra work to be done for that. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, we're out of time, so let's thank Mark. Good, we've now got half an hour for morning tea.